Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 58 of season 11 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Simon Appleton of the Movie Mustache. Welcome back for another episode, Simon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're going to continue with this assault where we have to try and figure out, along with Easy and Winters, what the hell is going on? Because there's some things that are not really explained here that we're just going to have to try and guess. So, but it's still all done really, really well. There's no question about that.
No, with
the way that this whole thing plays out. So. Episode 58 begins with the men taking target practice and ends with Winters sprinting ahead of everyone. So we ended things yesterday with Winters and the men finally getting to the, I guess, top of this hill, or to the area where the Germans are, and they're getting ready to, you know, everyone is anticipating the opening salvo of this battle, and they just start shooting at the Germans, and this episode begins with them literally taking pot shots and hitting a lot of the Germans that are there, which must be great for their egos at this point, you know, take out as many as possible along the way. And we see that the mortar guys also, you know, you have Cobb and the other mortar guys just shooting off some of their rockets also to help with the assault as the men all start moving, and then you know, they decide that they're just gonna, you know, start retreating, and you know, someone screams, "Fall back, fire!" And
it's impressive that they were able to get so many men so close without being discovered. Fact that they were able to get their first shots in, and that was what alerted the Germans to the fact they were there, was their gunfire. I heard something over there in the ditch, or do you hear that coming over the dike? It was the opening salvo.
Yeah. No, it's great the way that they show this, you know, because of the fact that you know, usually in a movie they'll have like someone make a little bit of a noise or something like that. I mean, even we had it last week when Bull was in the barn and, you know, the farmer's daughter accidentally hit the pail or whatever it was.
Yeah. You
know, so. And you know, just the way that they here they show the truth that nobody even heard them as they were going. And then Winters goes, "Higgins, handful of krauts, based on the dike, 12 o'clock."
Again, no hesitation,
none whatsoever.
No stopping to think about it. Just instantly makes a decision, gets it done.
That's right. And again, the idea of constantly you know, changing position is also a good idea, you know, so that you're not always in the same spot that you're going to get shot at. And they reach the mortars, and Cobb says, "How many crops are left up there?" And Liebherr goes, "I don't know, but we got 7 in one blow." And Winters isn't stopping, and he goes, "Bring on Boyle and Bricanti, go."
Yeah, he goes, straight back into back. Right, what we're doing next. There's no time to celebrate, no time to wait for tea and medals. Straight into next job.
That's right. And I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, the idea is that, you know, when you're in the middle of you have to constantly send a barrage on your enemy to keep their heads down and keep them from shooting at you. I mean, it's not the same thing, but like when I play backgammon, one of my goals is as many times as possible, as often as possible, to make sure that you know, that the person I'm playing against has, you know, pieces that have been taken off the board and have to get back in. You know, and I'd rather that they're spending the time dealing with that as while I'm moving, you know, my other pieces, you know, things like that.
Yep.
Even if sometimes I'm putting myself at risk by leaving something open, you know, that type of thing. But that's essentially what Winters is doing here also. You know, the idea that keep their heads down so that they're not going to be able to shoot at us, you know, and he starts screaming, suppressing fire, and he goes, Hashi, Garcia, follow me. And then Winters turns to Harry and goes, Harry, tell Peacock to bring the balance of first platoon on the double and another machine gun squad over. You know, it also shows the fact that Winters is using the radio himself as opposed to, you know, delegating something to someone who's, you know, to his radio man. I mean, we'll see. I don't remember if it's later today or tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow where he starts giving instructions to Luz, who's the who's his radio man. But here he's doing himself.
Yeah. And, every second counts.
That's right. And you know, he wants to bring as many men in here as possible in order to help out with this with this attack. And the more we have, the easier it'll be to finally take on the enemy and stuff like that.
Right. And even with having got that close successfully and having taken out however many Germans they actually got, he still has no idea what they're doing,
nope.
How many of them there are, or what their goal is, everything. He has no idea. He just knows there are Germans here. They're on the wrong side of the Rhine. Why? And I have to deal with that. Why they're here, we'll figure out later.
Right. Exactly. And then he starts barking more orders and goes, Dukeman, go get that machine gun on the right flank. Go. Dukeman gets up and starts running over, and then he screams, Christensen. And then we see that Dukeman gets hit, and one of the guys goes, Dukeman's down. At this point, they have an amazing transition between the gunfire and the sounds of the tapping of the typewriter.
Yes. Keys. I can only imagine how difficult it was to line those up perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of Saving Private Ryan, where you have, gunfire and rain that they mix together also, you know, when they're they're getting to the town, you know, where they eventually meet up with Captain Hamill. You know, so
I seem to think you see the raindrops on the leaf and then you see the boots running through puddles.
Right. And then, you know, the sounds just mesh together and they just do it really well. So, you know, I guess they figured it worked well there. Why don't we do it here? And instead of, you know, since Tom Hanks is here, let's use the sound of the typewriter keys instead of something else. So yeah,
and that brings it. Yeah, the sound effects they blend perfectly. It's very well done, but also it leans towards the idea that Winters is now facing of reducing something. This whole battle, all the emotion, Dukeman's just been killed. Thankfully, he's the only casualty of this, which is impressive given the amount of Germans they were going up against.
Right.
And obviously, he doesn't know that yet. And trying to reduce all of that to a few pieces of paper. And trying to coordinate your thoughts and your feelings and everything. And just try and get the basic facts into a military report, which doesn't want any of the emotion of it or all of that, the effect of it. They just want to know what happened, how.
Exactly. You know, the who, what, where, when, and how, and why. Of it all.
Yeah.
Like if you're just writing an article for the school newspaper or something, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But it's just also there's the fast-paced nature of this whole thing is just great also.
Yeah.
You know, I like the way that it's just jumping back and forth.
Yes. Yeah, literally like it is him remembering that what we are experiencing is his recollection of this whole scenario.
Right. Now the book about Band of Brothers actually explains what happened to Dukeman, because for us we just hear he's hit. That's it. Nothing else. There's no other explanation as to what really what specifically happened at that point. I'm gonna read the paragraph from the book on page 115, and it says, as the patrol waited for the reinforcements, Sergeant William Dukeman stood up to shout at the men to spread out. As Gordon Carson, who recalled the incident, remarked, the men will congregate in a minute. Three Germans hiding in a culvert that ran under the road fired a rifle grenade. Dukeman gave a sigh and slumped forward. He was the only man hit. A chunk of steel went into his shoulder blade and came out through his heart, killing him. The survivors opened up with the rifles and the Germans in the culvert and killed them in return. So again, that's the only, you have was it 5 lines that explain what happened to him for the whole thing. But again, I love the attention to detail, especially when dealing with the with real people. They're just going to mention the name and that's it. So I like the way that they do that. I mean, well, I've talked about that many times, how you're going to have something that's just a sentence in the book, but they're able to expand on it in the miniseries itself and tell us so much, show us so much more, about how it plays out. And the perfect example is the spaghetti incident. The spaghetti incident is one line, but the writer took that and said, okay, I'm going to write an entire scene that describes this whole thing.
And their feelings towards a certain officer.
Yeah, exactly. And at this point, they we come back to the men, and now it's morning. We can see that it's light outside, and we're so meaning that they I guess either fought through the night or just were able to fend them off and hold them off through the course of the night. Which works well also with the way that they're doing the
It's
thing.
an interesting transition as well from the point of view of when they come in, they did a really good job of making it feel dark and misty. They're obviously, you can see it's being lit, but the way they do it is it gives it this is moonlight sort of feel. And then there's you come back and it's daylight, and there's this whole that extra element of oh dear, because now you're in the same position, but you've lost one of your advantages. Now you can very clearly be seen wherever you are, and it definitely, especially the way they come back in on Winters and Talbot, who comes in to talk to him, it there's that a feeling of exposure. And the reason why I asked to be on this episode is because I've actually been to this place where this battlefield took place. There's you drive down the road. The road's on top of the dike. I'm not sure if it's the original dike, because I know the after Easy Company left that area, because they're right on the front line. As they're advancing on the Germans, the Rhine River is on their left, and that's the front line. And you drive along top of the road. I know the Germans blew up the dike after they left, but the dike is there. And you drive along, and there's just at the corner of this field where the crossroads is a little marker, a little piece of metal in the shape of a rifle stuck into the ground with a helmet on top, like a battle grave. And that's it. And I was in this field. There was no one there. I was in this field alone, walking along top of the dike, walking through the field. There is a ditch there that looks like where they put the mortars. I can't be sure that that is it, but there was a ditch there. So it gives you a sense of the place. And they've done a really good job of recreating that area. So it gave you an idea when I went there, it gave you an idea of what had happened, what had taken place there. And it just that level of exposure that comes into it when you come back and it's daylight feels more real, because it really does feel like they've got the crossroads, they can hide on the other side of the road, which just drops down. They've got cover, whereas where the Americans are coming up, they're completely exposed and they're almost trapped, because if the Germans had come along across the top of the dike, they could have fired down onto their position and decimated them. But yeah, so it's quite humbling at the very least to go there and see it and see where they were.
So did you like climb up the side and then back on into the dike itself and all that stuff when you were there?
Oh yeah, I climbed along the top of the dike. As I said, I drove in along the top of the dike, because that's where the road is. And then there's no one around. There's no fences. Well, there were a couple of fences, but there were gates open, and there was nothing to say. So I just wandered. I was there for over an hour, just wandering around, taking it in, taking random pictures of bits of grass and road, because knowing what took place there. Because for one, I've read the book. For another, the show portrays it so well. It's just interesting to get a sense of this is where it actually happened, and it looks very, very similar.
Wow.
And as I say, it just
My
gives you an
assumption,
idea of.
right. From what I understand, they didn't film it in the real dike. So, that also
No.
to recreate it is already
Yeah.
something.
But as I say, not long after Easy Company left that area, the Germans, I don't know if it was another attempt at regaining territory, or if it was just a, well, we don't have it, so you can't have it. They blew up the dike and the whole area flooded.
Oh,
I
okay.
know a lot of Dutch people lost their homes because they did that.
Oh,
And then obviously they did more nasty things because the Allies had dared come up there to the Dutch people as well.
you see what Dick Winters did. All right. So now it's daylight, and Talbert crawls over to Winters, and he goes, "Sir, the balance of first platoon is here. Gordon and Moore brought another 30 cal," which just goes, "They're behind a solid roadway embankment. We're in a ditch. They can outflank us along the dike and catch us out here as soon as they figure that out." "How many krauts are we talking about?" He goes, "There's a ferry crossing here. There could be a whole battalion, as far as I know." And he says this as he's looking at the map, which again shows Winters as someone who is able to gauge the situation so well and know exactly what he's talking about and what he's looking at. I just love the way they do that. You have Talbert coming and talking to him, and he's busy reading the map and saying, "Well, how am I going to be able to, outmaneuver them so that they don't outflank us?" That type of thing. And I like the fact that they mention it that nobody has any clue how many men are here, which is great, because from a soldier's perspective, you can look at it that he's saying, "Okay, this is my duty. It doesn't matter how many people are there. I have to go attack. There could be, two soldiers there, and there could be 200 soldiers there, but it doesn't matter. My job is to take my men and have a frontal assault and decimate whoever's there. That type of thing. And
His
there's no
hands are quite
hesitation.
tied.
No, but there's also no hesitation on his part. He's not saying to himself, "Oh, well, there could be 200 people there, so I'm not going to go." He's like, "This is my duty. This is what I need to do. These are the orders I've been given. I'm on my way." And I like that matter of fact attitude of how he does that.
Yeah, definitely.
At this point, Talbert then says, "Okay, so what are your orders?" He goes, "Well, we got no choice." And then they gather around with the other men, and he goes, "Here it is. Talbert, you'll take 10 men along the dike. Peacock, you'll take 10 men along the left flank. I'll take 10 up the middle. So follow me. Questions? Go." So again, one of the great things here is that he's now made this plan, and he says, "Okay, we're concerned that they're going to outflank us. So what we're going to do is we're going to go from three different directions. We know that we need 10 men from here, 10 men from there, 10 men from we have 30 men, let's split them up into three groups, and we're going to assault them from three different sides, which, it makes sense from a tactical perspective that that's the way he should be doing something like this. I like what
spread your assets.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's not just spread your assets. It's the idea of trying to box in the enemy. I think that's more what he's trying to do here. He's trying to make it so that if we go from three different directions, if my concern is they're going to outflank me, so we have to figure out a way that they're not going to be able to. Because if you go up one side, then they can run out from the other side and come around and outflank you.
Yes, exactly.
So it makes sense that he's looking at it from this perspective.
In a way, the dike almost acts as an advantage because
they can't see.
They can't see, and being on the other side, there's no use to it. That blocks their view as much as yours, so to speak. So putting the men on top of the dike, you've got high ground, and you've got the as far as it's worth going, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And then the shot changes again, and we get to see Winters still writing out this report, and he's he's chewing on his pencil, trying to figure out what it is that he needs to add here, on this report that he's doing this. But they give us a great perspective as to how much thought he's putting into this whole thing. Now, what do you think the reason is that people chew on pencils? You have any idea? Okay, sorry.
I honestly don't know. I'm guilty of it myself. I've never really put too much thought into it. It's just you're trying to get your words in order. It's there, and okay. What do you do with it other than chew on it?
Right. So I did a quick search, and I got five different possible reasons why people will do it. So one of them is anxiety and stress relief. Just like people bite their nails, so chewing provides a calming effect that soothes nerves when you're in the middle of a stressful task. Okay, that's the first one. Second one is focus and concentration. The fact that you're doing some sort of repetitive action, there are people that it helps maintain focus and stay alert when they're studying or working or things like that. And the third one is, it says sensory needs. So for some people, particularly neurodivergent individuals, I don't really know what that means, it allows them to put pressure on the jaw, which provides a grounding, calming effect. The fourth one is an orbital fixation or a habit that, we're not going to get into Freud's theories on this whole thing, but, some people just like putting things in their mouth.
Well, it's like smokers. Some smokers chew toothpicks, don't they, to get over the oral fixation of having a cigarette in the mouth.
Exactly. And the final reason that it gives here is boredom. As soon as people are just bored.
Yeah, I can see that.
I would guess that of those five reasons that we were just given here, the one that probably fits for Winters is the fact that he's trying to focus and concentrate on what he's doing.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. And then he's interrupted by a knock on the door, and he goes, enter, and Nixon shows up. And, Nixon, as always, has a little flask on him. And he goes, I don't know why I'm still doing this. And Winters looks at him and goes, what, drinking? He goes, no, hiding in your footlocker. And he walks over and opens up the footlocker and pulls out a bottle of booze.
Comforting habit, no doubt.
That's right, which I think is really funny because earlier, when in, I believe, the first part, when they were still in America and they were on a train, Nixon said that he's hiding all his booze in Winters' footlocker. And,
Winters isn't sure if he's joking or not.
That's right. But my assumption is that at this point, since it's probably like a year since then, since he said that, I really hope that Winters has seen that it's in his footlocker.
You'd like to think so.
Yeah, so he knows the purpose.
This is one of my favorite elements of the show is the relationship between both the characters and the actors. The two actors have a really great chemistry, but I really do enjoy the friendship between Winters and Nixon, because if you think about it, they really are very, very different people. In most circumstances, they probably wouldn't be friends, but in this case, they forged a friendship that lasted a lifetime until Nixon passed, I believe, in 1995.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it every time, the bond they share, and the little ways in that Nixon tries to help Winters in this situation, because he knows how good of a leader Winters is. He's seen how much he cares about his men, and it's without being obvious, he's just trying to help him get past this thing, because obviously also it was the last time he was in charge of Easy Company. But he is just trying to help his friend get through a traumatic moment without making it a big deal, without even trying to sound like he's helping. He's just trying to get him through it so as he can get past it.
Right. That's true. I mean, you mentioned the fact that, you know, that these two guys are in some ways opposites, but, you know, they complement one another, and that's why they work so well together. And, you know, as you said, the chemistry between both the actors and the characters is just so amazing to watch, because here you have these guys that you know, essentially became best friends for over 50 years until one of them passed away, you know, and that's just amazing the way that they can show the camaraderie that these two guys have, even though their personalities are 180 degrees differently, and also their actions are and their jobs are very different. You know, yep. Nixon doesn't want to be on the front.
No.
But Winters does. As far as Winters is concerned, yeah. You know, put me in the front, I'm willing to do it. You know, this is what I was born to do. You know, that type of thing. And Nixon's like, okay, I have to be here, and I'm going to do the best that I can. But you don't need to put me in any dangerous position, because I just want to, you know, that's why he's the intelligence officer. You know, he's not a frontline officer who's dealing with things. And I do like the fact, I mean, this is mentioned in a later episode. I'm trying to remember right now when, but, you know, there's a certain point where there is another airborne assault, and Nixon gets to for the third time, you know, jump from an airplane. And he's...
I believe it's episode 9.
Okay, there could be. Obviously, we're not there yet.
Yeah, but again, it will come to it, that what you've just described actually then starts to work against him.
Correct.
In his own mind, obviously.
Yeah.
And again, totally understandable.
Right. But again, that's the whole idea that Nixon is trying to get away from being on the front line, and every so often he gets pushed forward back to the front line, and Winters wants to be on the front line, and he keeps being held back from the front line.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like the tug of war that we get to see on that type of issue. I think that's great.
Definitely.
Now, the conversation the two of them have here is also great. So, you know, as I started saying before, Nixon goes and takes out the booze from the Foot Locker, and he goes, I don't know why I'm still doing this. And he goes, what, drinking? No, hiding in your Foot Locker. I'm a captain, for Christ's sake. Well, why don't you just give it up? Drinking? No, hiding it in my Foot Locker. You're a captain, for Pete's sake. Maybe you're right. Maybe this is the perfect place to stop drinking, right here on the business end of the Allied advance. And then he lifts up the, you know, the glass and goes, "Cheers!" And Winters just laughs, and he goes, you know, yeah. Nixon's getting ready to leave, and he sees that Winters is having a lot of trouble making this report. And he goes, Dick, you know that's not literature. Just keep it simple. Try writing it in the first person plural. Say we a lot. And yeah. He looks at him and he goes, thanks for the tip. Even though Nixon knows that Winters is not going to listen to him for this type of thing. But again, their relationship is such that they can give advice like this, even if they know that the other person is not going to take the advice. You know, but it's still a way to try and be as helpful as possible. So I like the way that they show that to us. You know, and they make it that
yeah, it humanizes them.
Yeah, completely. Completely. And it works. Works quite well. And at this point, we're back inside of the on the bottom of the dike, and you know Winters goes fix bayonets, and we see a bunch of the guys, some of them that we can recognize. You know, we see Percanti putting on it, and we see Bull putting on his bayonet, and we see Liebgott putting on the bayonet, and we we see even some of the new guys putting their bayonets on their gun, basically all getting ready for this upcoming assault. Now you see you see Garcia, you see Hashi also, and you can see the in their eyes that these men are all both anticipating and dreading the fact that they're about to once again go on this assault of the the dike area, because again they don't know what's there. And
also interesting that not so long ago Bull told one of his men, you won't be able to shoot straight with that on.
True, but there is the idea here that it depends on the situation. You know, you might not be able to shoot straight with it, but what you are going to be able to do is if you're in a situation where you need to go and fight hand to hand, you want to be able to have that you want to be able to have the bayonet on the back, on the top of the gun.
Yep. So a little bit extra reactionary gap.
Right. I mean, it works both ways from that perspective.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I like the way that they show that to us. And then Winters says, all right, go on the red smoke. And he goes, wait for the signal. And then he just gets up and starts running. And everyone else is behind him. You know, and the question remains, you know, is he expecting everyone to be right on his heels? Or is he, waiting? Does he really want to have such a huge gap between himself and the men?
See, I've read that's actually a little bit of fiction. I don't know how true this is, but I've read that he actually just ran. He was just a faster runner. He got there first because he ran faster.
Okay. It could be. I mean, we know that all these guys were in great shape because of everything they went through, when they were training in Tekoa, even the commanders. You know, I mean, one of the things that always jumps out at me that I think about from the book is the fact that when they were on the boat ride, you know, from New York to England, so. They continued doing, exercises, calisthenics and all that stuff, when everyone else was on this boat for 2 weeks, this cramped boat for 2 weeks, and they weren't able to do anything. But, Sobel made sure that they would continue to do, to keep themselves in shape. And there's also the case that I'm pretty sure it was when they went to, the paratrooper training, that when they got there, they were all in better shape than the instructors. who were supposed to be there to, to give them calisthenics and all that stuff, that they would tire them out because of the, everything that Sobel did for them. Which I think is great to know that that's, that that's the way that this all played out.
So. Well, he, it's nice in a way that all the hell that man put them through actually paid off.
Yes, yes. I mean, they all, in the book it mentions it, and based on things that I've heard from that the men have said, that they all know that if it wasn't for Sobel, they wouldn't have been so close, and they wouldn't have been as ready for battle as they were. You know, Sobel himself would not have been able to lead them, but he was able to get them into both physical shape and, I guess, military shape, because they knew how to do everything they needed to do because of the harsh way that he treated them.
It's much like in sports, people have coaches. The coach may not have necessarily achieved the highest levels or the awards that some of these sports men and women have achieved. However, they do know how to get them there.
Right. Exactly. And then one of the guys gets ready to start running, and he's held back by another guy, and he goes, "No, wait for the signal." So, again, that goes with what you're saying, that maybe, Winters was faster than everybody else, but maybe, at least the way they're portraying it here is that, they were waiting for the actual smoke to start going. So
it's a very interesting dilemma, because on the one hand, do you really want to run over there? But your buddy, your boss, your leader is running off over there and wanting to tear off after them. It must have been an interesting combination of drive and emotion. I don't want to go over there, but he's gone over there. I need to go over there. I'd rather stay here. All these things swirling around all at once. I mean, must have been quite overwhelming at times, I can imagine.
Yeah. And as this guy is being held back, and we see Winter still running, that's where this 5-minute segment ends. So, is there anything else that you wanted to mention about this 5-minute segment?
It's more of a general thing. It's just. And it will apply across all three episodes that we're covering, that I'm with you. It's just they really nail the combination of the sound effects and visuals, and they make it look like organized chaos. There's none of the Hollywood war movie glamour, for lack of a better term, to it. It does look like a horrible experience in many ways, and I can imagine. Even just shooting it, there were times when it was a bit cold and miserable and chaotic. And I think that really works for it. It adds a layer of authenticity to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I think it does too. Again, it the whole thing just feels very realistic.
So yes.
It's great the way they
definitely.
Okay, so today's segment is a game. We will play a game of World War II movie trivia. So let's spin the wheel and see what questions Simon will get. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Who directed the 2014 movie The Monuments Men?
George Clooney.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Excellent. Nicely done. All right. Let's spin the wheel again for your next question. Okay. There is a movie from 1955 that deals with British, Dutch, French, and Polish prison allied prisoners in a German POW camp that is in a castle. Do you know what the name of that castle was?
Colditz.
Correct. And the name of the movie is The Colditz Story, which is why I couldn't tell you the name of the, tell you what the
That
movie was, because that would have given away that question. Round and
worries.
round and round it goes. Okay, the 1998 movie The Thin Red Line is based on a novel by whom?
Since the Thin Red Line in ages. Is it James Jones?
Yes, it is. Very good. Excellent. Nicely done. All right.
Suddenly
In
got
for your.
lucky there.
There's no luck involved. It's the idea that we all know useless getting delinquents. That's what it comes down to. In the 1969 movie The Bridge at Remagen, what is the Bridge at Remagen?
It's the last bridge over the Rhine, I
Excellent.
believe,
Yes, it
and
is.
it's the one that the Germans failed to blow up.
That's right. Excellent.
Yep.
Nicely done. Nicely done. All right, let's spin the wheel for your final question. Okay, can you name three of the five men sent on the mission to deal with the guns of Navarone?
Another one I haven't seen in a long time. What was their names? I believe David Niven played someone called
No, you don't have to name
Miller.
the right, but you don't need to name the characters. I want to know who the actors are. But yes, David Niven is one of them.
You want the actors,
Yeah,
not the
yeah, yeah,
Gregory Peck, obviously.
yeah.
Idiot. Main character, and Anthony Quayle.
Very good. Very good. Do you know who the other two are by any chance? Or not?
No.
Okay, so Anthony
Those are the
Quinn.
ones that stuck. Oh, yeah.
And Stanley Baker. Yeah, those are the other two. All right, excellent. Nicely done. You see, and you were concerned. Come on. No reason to
Yeah.
be concerned at all. You
That's
did
like when my friends always say, "Oh, what's good coming out in the cinema?" And they expect me to know because I'm the movie geek.
and that makes sense though, doesn't it?
In a way, yeah.
All right. So now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. And we'll see if it happens to coincide with any of the movies that we just talked about. It's possible. So let's spin the wheel and see what we got. Nope, it's not one of them. Okay. So this is a movie from 1965 starring George Segal about soldiers in a POW camp in the Pacific.
King Rat, isn't
Yes, it is. Excellent. You see, you did really well.
it? Unlike last time when I was awful.
Okay, so you know that you know this better than than being
Whatever
able to
rules we were
guess.
talking on,
No, well,
Saving Private Ryan.
same problem, Ryan. We were dealing with with quotes from character, so that sort of it's slightly different. Slightly different. But that's okay. Nicely done. All right, so would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
You can find my site, The Movie Mustache, at moviemustache.com. You can find me on all the usual socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, at movie_mustache. Or, as I said yesterday, due to some Facebook-related nonsense, on Facebook, it's The Movie Mustache 2.0.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow, curry!
Curry!